I grew up preaching and ministering in a religious tradition other than the Presbyterian Church, and occasionally found myself in the U.S. ministering. And a friend of mine once said, it must be kind of nice to be in those churches in the South where when you're preaching, they encourage you and they say, amen, preach it, brother. And I say, well, that depends on how it's going. Because the congregation says one of two things. If the sermon is going really well, you get, amen, preach it, brother. And if it's not going really well, they say, help him, Jesus. Help him, Jesus. So if you're in trouble, you get to... Okay. Well, I'm pretty inquisitive. I like history, I like science, and I thought I should tell you that I conducted a very significant scientific experiment as I was on the home stretch of preparation yesterday. I had a couple things to do at the church before I headed over, and I had all of my sermon material prepared, and when I do a little bit more historical and background work, I come with more complete notes and had almost 200 pages of notes ready to go. And got to the church, and I'm running around. Somebody came to pick up some keys, do a few other things. And I discovered how much club soda you can pour into the keyboard of a laptop before things go wrong. It's just under half a liter, it turns out. And as I saw the glass of club soda go over and fall, I got to tell you, you've never seen anybody hit the print button this fast. And but the notes are all here. So I'll be dealing with the keyboard of my laptop when I go home Monday morning. We'll see what kind of condition that's in. I was struck as we're here in this place about the interesting situation that has developed for many of the nuns and the priests and some of the monks who still serve in many of our monasteries in North America as the attendance has dwindled. In this place, if I understand correctly, as in many other places, as there are fewer and fewer nuns, and as they have to try and find a way to keep this facility going, they have discovered that by serving others, they find their own survival. And I thought that's an interesting thought. I wonder where I've heard that before, that when you give your life away in serving others that you find your own life. And I think that as many of our churches are struggling, the normal intuitive thing to do is to retrench and circle the wagons and hang on to your money and hang on to your budget and protect your building and do all you can to survive. And I think more and more of our congregations are discovering that they're finding survival and health and growth and the Lord's blessing as they are looking outward and thinking of ways that they need to be serving the community. And I don't know all of the churches that you're from, but certainly I encourage you to take that example, at least home from the nuns who are serving us this weekend, that for them, serving others in practicing hospitality has become something that allows them to continue to exist and to continue their ministry here. May the Lord touch us in that direction. As we start this morning, I just want to give you a quick note about numbers in the Hebrew text of the Old Testament, not numbers the book, but numbers as in digits and numerals. And I mention this because there's a couple of textual issues with the text that we'll read this morning. The Hebrew, like many other languages, including Latin, does not have numbers. It uses letters to represent numbers. If you remember back to elementary school and high school, you remember that in Roman numerals, M is a million, and X is 10, and C is 100. The same thing happens in Hebrew. And so in the Hebrew text of the Old Testament, there's a number of places where there are numbers that are mentioned, and it's letters that are used to represent the numbers. And in a few places, because the manuscript has degraded a little bit, it's hard to pick up the numbers. And so there's a few places in a few key texts, including in our text today, where it talks about the reign of Saul, in particular where it talks about the number of men that the Philistines mustered together. We're not sure that we've got those numbers accurately. Something has happened to the manuscripts there, and we're not sure about the numbers and the quantities. Now, I always get into these discussions. Some people see that and they really start to panic. That means there could be a mistake in the Bible. Well, I want to tell you this, just to build your confidence. Depending on whether or not you use the Apocrypha, there's 31,102 verses in the Bible, from Genesis to Revelation. Out of 31,102 verses in the Bible, there are 42 verses where we've got textual questions. So 42 out of 31,000, that's not a bad percentage. Those 42 verses that are in question include the 12 or 13 verses of the story of the woman caught in adultery at the beginning of John 8, which is not in some of our oldest manuscripts. And those 42 verses include the 14 or 15 verses at the end of the Gospel of Mark, where we're not quite sure about the ending of the Gospel of Mark. So you take those two texts out, we're left with about 15 verses in the totality of Scripture where we're not sure about a specific word or about a specific number. So that's a pretty good batting average. The second thing you need to know is that in most of our good English translation, where there is a question about the original text, it will tell you. There'll be a square bracket, there'll be a note at the bottom of the page that says something about the manuscripts are not sure here if the number is 3 or 30 or 300 or 3,000. And that, in my mind, is a pretty honest way to approach it. The other thing you need to know is that none of those textual variations have any significant bearing on our understanding of the faith. Whether Solomon had 300 horses or 3,000 horses in his stables does not make a huge difference in your understanding of redemption and salvation. So there you go. That being said, by the way, it's interesting to point out that as believers, as Christians, we have a different approach to our holy text than do the Muslims. The Muslims believe that in heaven there is a perfect copy of the Quran. And when they get to heaven, one of their pastimes will be memorizing and learning and studying the Quran. We do not believe there is a perfect copy of the Bible in heaven. We believe that when we get to heaven, the need for the Bible will have passed. Because we believe that the Bible is a testimony to the Lord Jesus Christ. And spending eternity in heaven studying the Bible would be like me sitting next to my wife in a restaurant and staring at her picture in my wallet. We approach things much more delicately, much differently. And when I am witnessing and reaching out and connecting with unbelievers, with people who have questions, whether or not the Bible may have lost a verse or two along the way is not my first subject of conversation. What they believe about Jesus Christ is far more significant, and I point them in that direction. So that being said, let's look at our text. We're going to cover quite a bit of ground this morning. And the way I'd like to do that is I'll read through the text and then interrupt a couple different spots. We're going to be reading from 1 Samuel 13 and starting at verse 1. Saul lived for 1 year and then became king. We believe he lived for 1 year during that period where he had been anointed but hadn't quite become king, and we think that's what the 1 year refers to. But this is one of these verses where we've got a question about whether it's the 1 year or whether there's a number mistake there. Saul chose 3,000 men of Israel. 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash in the hill country of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin. The rest of the people he sent home, every man to his tent. You remember what had happened, he cut the oxen in two, 30,000 men came, they freed Jabesh Gilead that had been attacked, and so he still got these 30,000 men, he sends 27,000 home, he just keeps 3,000. Jonathan defeated the garrison of the Philistines that was at Geba, and the Philistines heard of it. And Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear." And all Israel heard it. All Israel heard it said that Saul had defeated the garrison of the Philistines, and also that Israel had become a stench to the Philistines, and the people were called out to join Saul at Gilgal. During Israel's history, there's a number of different enemies that attack for a variety of reasons. During the period of the judges, there are a number of greater powers that were coming and going, and typically when they attacked for food and for money. It's a desert area. The Midianites, when they attack, usually would attack at harvest time. They would come in and steal the crops. Basically, they'd let the Israelites plant and work all summer. And then at the end of the summer, when the crops were ready, the Midianites would come in and swoop up the crops. They got very smart about this, actually. Near the end, what they would do is that they would even let the Israelites harvest the crops, store it in the barns, and the Midianites would swoop in and just empty out the barns. You remember that when Gideon is called, he's hiding, threshing the wheat, getting it ready. They didn't want the foreign enemies to know the crop was ready. That's why he was hiding doing that. When the Romans attack Israel much later, before the coming of Christ, they do so for a different reason. They're protecting a trade route to Egypt. The Roman Empire is hungry. When the famine attacks Jerusalem, it also is attacking Rome. There's a shortage of food in the Roman Empire. And the wheat and the barley and a couple of other things are coming from Egypt, which is the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. And the Romans still do not sail clear across the Mediterranean Sea. They haven't got that skill yet. So they have a marine highway that hugs the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. And so from Egypt, the ships leave. They look more like barges than anything else. And they travel for a day or two and they set in port, a day or two and in port, a day or two and in port, all the way along the perimeter of the Mediterranean Sea until they get to Italy and into Rome. Because of that, the Romans want to protect the coastline. And on the coastline is this weird, strange, religious place called Israel. And there's always revolt and revolution going on, and it's an awful place. If you're a Roman soldier and you misbehave, they don't ship you off to Siberia. They send you off to Jerusalem. That's the punishment. That's the place where you go to, you know, fade out at the end of your career when you've messed up. That's why Pilate was sent there. He'd made a couple mistakes and he got sent there, and it didn't get any better for him. He finishes his life in exile. So when the Romans attack Israel, they don't have a political issue with Israel. They're not interested in the territory. The problem is these Jews just won't behave, and it's endangering the shipping route that's supposed to get the wheat from Egypt to a very hungry Rome. Now, the enemies that we're dealing with in 1 and 2 Samuel and the book of Kings, it's all about territory. If you take a look at the map that I've got for you, the smallest of the maps, it's right after page 10, and you can see what surrounds them. We spoke yesterday about Ammon and Moab and Edom that are on the eastern side of Israel. Down at the bottom is Amalek. We'll talk about them a little bit later. And then the Philistines on the left there, sandwiched between Israel and the sea. And all of those people groups are right there. They're growing in population. They need fields. They need harvest area. They need arable, fertile land. And all of that land belongs to Israel. And so they're moving, and it's a territory issue. I mentioned yesterday that by the time the Israelites arrive, the Philistines have gotten established in much of the land. And in fact, it's the Philistines that gave their name to Palestine. Palestine is a deformation of the word Philistine. So Saul has been called to the throne, and in fact, when he's anointed, God tells Samuel that Saul's first order of business is going to be dealing with the Philistines. And so Saul sets up the first permanent army. These 30,000 men come together in the pinch of the emergency yesterday to free Jabesh-Gilead. He takes what we think are the best 3,000 men, and he prepares them into a standing army. He's pretty strategic about this. He prepares for his first skirmish with the Philistines. And Saul is thinking about this. He's a pretty good military strategist. He doesn't know how well armed the Philistines are. He's never seen them fight. He wants to see what their fighting technique is like. And he wants to test their strength. And so what he does is that he picks one of the little strongholds. The Philistines have been sending raiding parties into Israel. And spread out throughout Israel, there's a number of little strongholds that the Philistines have established. It's, we think, the beginning of a beachhead. The Philistines eventually want to attack Israel, and the way they've done it, they send in a raiding party, they take over a little village, fortify it, take over another little village, fortify it, and they're getting all these little beachheads established in Israel. And so Saul divides the group in two. He takes 1,000 men, sends them with Jonathan, and he sends them in to try and take one of these little Philistine strongholds. This is a good test. He wants to see how well the Philistines fight. Defending armies always have an advantage over the attackers, so he's going to see how strong the Philistines are when they defend. The other advantage is that when you're attacking, if things go wrong, you can call it quits and go home, right? If you attack, it's not going well, you can just cut losses and run. That's probably good advice when you're on your first date, right? You never have a first date at home. You have a first date at a restaurant, and that way if things go bad, you can pull out before dessert, right? This is, dating advice. You never thought you'd get it, but here you go. It's part of the... So Jonathan wins this first little skirmish, and it goes really, really well. And this brings the added advantage that there's good news. So Saul has won his first victory against the Philistines, and he's claimed back a piece of Jewish territory. And there's another result, and we think this is what Saul wanted. The Philistines are drawn out to attack. So what Saul has done is that he's prepared his forces, he's waiting for the Philistines, and he sends Jonathan with 1,000 men. They attack a stronghold, they capture it, they win it back, party, victory, we've got our first victory against the Philistines. Jonathan comes back with 1,000 men, and they sit and wait at Gilgal. Gilgal at this point is basically the capital city. Jerusalem has not been reclaimed yet, hasn't been built in the capital. So the city of Gilgal in the south is where Saul is, where his forces are. We think by this time they've fortified the city. It's good approach. They send a foray out, make the Philistines angry, Philistines recoup, and now they're going to come to attack. But Saul has a surprise he doesn't expect. The Philistines round up a lot more men than Saul expected. We have a problem with the number of men that the Philistines get together. Because we know at this point that the Philistine population is not this large, and it would have been hard just on the basis of the Philistine population to put together this large an army. There's two theories that are suggested. One is that this is one of the places where there's a problem with the manuscript by a factor of zero. The other possibility is that the Philistines have rounded up some of their buddies around Israel. They've hired a couple mercenaries, and they're thinking this is their shot. This is their chance. They're going to work together to take Israel out. And I think this is what's happened. So Saul is expecting the Philistines to come at him, and to his surprise, there's thousands more men than they expect. And they have another surprise. When the Philistines come at them, not only are there more men than they expect, but they're better armed than Saul had been led to understand. Now, the Israelites know that they have a disadvantage. The Philistines had developed technology that they brought with them from the Phoenicians. They're great at metalworking. They're working with silver and bronze and a couple of other metals that the Israelites aren't using yet. And they've also developed the keen science of sharpening tools, plowshares, swords, and knives, which the Israelites don't have yet. They don't have that ability. And in fact, one of the problems there is that when the Israelites need stuff sharpened, they have to go to the little Philistine outposts and pay. We're told how much money it costs to sharpen a sword or a plowshare. So the Israelites can't do that. Now, you can just imagine when, during the Cold War, when the Americans and the Russians were at war, imagine if the Americans had to go to the Russians to build their nuclear warheads. It wouldn't have gone well. Well, this is what's happening. The Israelites depend on the Philistine to get their swords and to get their swords sharpened. So Saul knows he's at a disadvantage, but he's not expecting this huge crowd. And the other thing that is a shock is that the Philistines have apparently been trading actively with Egypt. And as they get their forces together, not only do they outnumber the Israelites, not only do they have better weapons, but on top of that, they have several detachments of cavalry and chariots, which the Israelites did not expect. And so as the Philistines assemble, the battle lines for the confrontation are drawn, and Saul begins to panic. Let's pick up at verse 5 of 1 Samuel 13. And the Philistine mustered to fight with Israel 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen and troops like the sand on the seashore in multitude. They came up and encamped in Michmash to the east of Beth-Aven. When the men of Israel saw that they were in trouble, for the people were hard-pressed. The people hid themselves in caves and in holes and in rocks and in tombs and in cisterns. And some Hebrews crossed the fjords of the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. Saul was still at Gilgal, and all the people followed him, trembling. There is panic. They begin to run. Now, if you think that people don't run from their posts in panic, you haven't been following the court-martial in the U.S. that's been happening these days. Apparently, soldiers still do that today, even in Afghanistan. So the men begin to scamper and hide. And Saul's got a problem. Saul wants to attack before the group gets too large. The Philistine camp is growing and growing and growing by the day. They're bringing the weapons out. They're drawing the battle lines. They're getting ready to attack. Saul wants to make first strike, but there's something they haven't done yet. Samuel needs to come to offer the sacrifice and do the ritual cleansing for the men before they go to battle. And Saul is waiting. And Samuel says, I'll be there during the week. And Monday goes by, and Tuesday goes by, and Wednesday goes by, and there's no Samuel, and there's more and more Philistines. And Thursday goes by, and Friday goes by, and there's no Samuel, and there's more and more Philistines. And so verse 8 of chapter 13, so Saul waited 7 days, the time appointed by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him. So Saul said, bring the burnt offering here to me, and the peace offerings. And he offered the burnt offering. As soon as he had finished offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came. Great timing, huh? And Saul went out to meet him and greet him. Samuel said, what have you done? And Saul said, when I saw that the people were scattering from me and that you did not come within the days appointed and that the Philistines had mustered at Michmash, I said, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I've not sought the favor of the Lord. So I forced myself and I offered the burnt offering. And Samuel said to Saul, you have done foolishly. You have not kept the command of the Lord your God with which he commanded you. For then the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be prince over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. And Samuel arose and went up from Gilgal. The rest of the people went up after Saul to meet the army. They went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin. And Saul numbered the people who were present with him, about 600 men. The rest of the 3,000 had left. Now, if you've ever watched an action thriller, you know that moment in the film. The hero's about to do something dangerous. You know, he gets into a car, and he's got the keys in the ignition, and you know that in the scene before, the bad guys, the KGB or whoever he is, that, you know, has hot-wired the car with a bomb, and you know as soon as he turns the key that the car is going to explode on them, and you sit there, and everybody in the theater's like, don't do it! Don't do it! Don't start! Don't open the door! Don't do this! And if you've read the story, when you get to this point in the story and you know that nobody but Samuel is supposed to offer the burnt offering, you sit there and you see Saul, and he's this great military hero, and he's got these victories, and the Lord has blessed him, and it's going well, and it's, you know, and you watch him and you go, don't do it. I always get that feeling when I read this text. I want to jump in and say, Saul, what are you doing? Now, I wonder whether Saul had been reading about what happened in some of the neighboring countries. You know, in some of the countries around him, the king had the right of priesthood. Not only that, but in many of the surrounding countries, not only was the king equivalent to the priest, in many of the other surrounding countries, the king was superior to the priest. In fact, in many of the surrounding countries, they wouldn't have been offering things to God. They would have been bringing burnt offerings to the king as the god of the country. And I don't know whether this is starting to go to Saul's head. I don't know what's happening in Saul's mind. Or whether it's just sheer panic. And I want to stand up for Saul again this morning. Before you throw a stone at Saul, I want to ask which one of you has never been in that moment of panic where to get out of trouble you were ready to tell a lie, cut on your taxes a little bit, hit the gas pedal and go 120 in a 100 zone, Any of these things ring a bell? You know, there's those little things where the temptation is strong to cut a corner. You get to the end of the year, you're filling out your taxes, and you're just a couple hundred bucks short. And you think, man, wouldn't it be great if that thing there was a tax deduction? And by golly, give yourself 20 minutes and you've reasoned your way into thinking, yeah, that's a tax, that's a tax deduction. That was a gift. I don't need to declare. That was a gift. I don't need to declare that. But you know, that's not what this is about. This is about something bigger. This is about doing the work of God, fighting the Philistines just like he asked you. You're giving it all you've got, and he doesn't seem to be responding, and he doesn't seem to be giving you the resources you need. You're doing his work. You're doing ministry. And there's this unbelievable opportunity. You could take ministry to the next level if only this. We're fighting tax situation with the city with several of our manses. City has changed the way they apply the tax code. They haven't changed the tax code, they've changed the way they apply it. They're now telling us that in order to be tax exempt, a church building in a manse has not only to belong to a church, but it has to be actively used for ministry. So they've told us if a manse is empty, as in if there's a manse that doesn't have a minister in it or a priest in it because one has resigned and the other one hasn't come in yet, during the time that the manse is empty, municipal and school taxes are chargeable on the manse.
Oh, yes.
Yes, this is the new reading of the law. So I don't know what they're doing out here on the West Island, but in Montreal, the city inspectors are actually visiting manses and sitting in front of the manses and watching whether the lights come on at night and watching whether anybody picks up the mail. And we've been paying taxes on two of our Presbyterian manses. And now the city has said, when your manse is empty, we expect you to declare to us that it's empty. So what do you do? And there are moments where we've convinced ourselves that the work that we do, that the ministry that we do, that our calling is so high and so important and so significant that it's okay to take shortcuts because we're serving a higher purpose. And the higher purpose, the end to which we are working, justifies the way that we're going to get there. But you see, here's the thing. To God, it's not just about what we're doing, it's about who we are. It's not just about what we're accomplishing, it's about who we are becoming and who God calls us to be. God always calls his people to be different, to live by a different standard. And yes, the glory of God would be shown when Israel wins a glorious victory against the Philistines, but that glory would be spoiled if shortcuts were taken along the way. When I moved into Côte de Neige and started doing ministry there 5 years ago, one of the things that brought me great joy is that I live in one of the only boroughs in Montreal over which there is a lit cross that watches 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I work in the shadow of the oratory. And as I take the bus back and forth to the manse after evening services and during the week, I like the fact that from most places in the borough, as I wait at the bus stop at night, I can turn and I can see the cross that's lit on top of St. Joseph's Oratory. There's actually a running joke because I serve on several committees for the borough, and a lot of our publications for the borough picture the oratory because it's our big landmark. And the photographers of the borough are very skilled at taking pictures of the oratory where the cross doesn't show. They sort of strategically place a tree branch or sort of, you know, artistically cut it off so that you can tell it's the oratory, but the cross kind of is sort of missing from the top. It's incredible skill with which they do this. And then about a month ago, the news hit of the class action lawsuit against the Brothers of the Sacred Cross who run the teaching schools around the oratory. And now for people in our borough, this cross on the oratory is no longer the symbol of the love of Christ. It's a symbol of a couple of pedophile priests who are now paying the price for years of sin imposed on little kids. As believers, what we do matters, but often how we do it is far more significant. And it doesn't take a sexual abuse case. For several years, my mom and dad worked with a little church in Farnham. And this little church in Farnham, after the war in 1950, 1951, 52, there was a lot of evangelism that happened. There were no Protestant churches and no French Protestant churches in that area. And there's a couple of, there's two couples who came into the city, into the district, and started doing door-to-door work and Bible studies and reaching out to French Canadians in the park. And they built a little nucleus of 30 or 40 believers, and they wanted to build a church. The problem was the city council had said that they would not allow a French Protestant church to be built on the city territory. And so they bought a piece of land. They were going to build a church there. But the city said, you can't build a church. And one of the guys had this great idea. He said, well, actually, we're going to build a school. Oh, okay, if it's a school, then fine, you can build a school. So they built what looked like a school, and lo and behold, in the school, on Sundays, they started to do services. And the city council said, wait. This is a church. No. This is a Sunday school. And today in 2017 in the town of Farnham, when you talk to somebody about the gospel, they go, oh, this, yeah, you're part of that group that told the lie about the school building with the church, and yeah. You're part of those liars who said they were building, yeah. Now, this was 67 years ago. And it's still hard to preach the gospel in Farnham, because when you preach the gospel in Farnham, oh yeah, I know you, yeah, this is funny, yeah? Hey honey, look, he's with those guys that said they were building a school, yeah! And anytime any drives by the church with some friends, oh yeah, see, let me tell you the story about this building, yeah, these guys said they were building it, yeah. 60 years later. We have an interesting situation where we are at Côte de Neige, and I keep telling people, when people ask me how things are going at Côte de Neige, I tell them the Lord is doing really neat things, and I'm just trying not to get in the way. I had a lot of ideas about stuff that we would try when we started at Côte de Neige, and I've got to tell you, I really haven't a chance to try any of them yet, because the Lord's kept us busy with other stuff that He knew we needed to do first. And a couple of weeks after I'd arrived, I took a call, and somebody from Mount Royal Cemetery, and they were looking for John Vaudry, my predecessor. And John was no longer there. I said, can I help you? And the lady said, well, do you do funerals? I said, well, I guess. I do, yeah. And I said, when? And she said, well, are you busy in 20 minutes? And somebody had canceled out. See, this is why you listen to your wife, because my wife always says, make sure you keep a clean shirt and a jacket at the church, just in case. I do that now. And the Lord has opened this ministry that we never expected. I did a funeral on Wednesday this past week. It was just a short burial, actually. And this was my 183rd funeral in 5 years. Only about 8 or 9 of those have been for members of our congregation. And a lot of French Canadians, a lot of Montrealers of any language, no longer have any connection with church. But grandma dies, and they want somebody to come and pray. And the weird ones, actually, are the people who ask the cemetery to find a minister, and then when I get there, they say, okay, yeah, no Bible readings, no prayers or anything, but, and I go, you know I'm a minister, right? They go, yeah, but would you know, they want me there because I'm a comforting presence, because I've got this, you know, short line to God, I guess. But when they tell me they don't want any prayers, I feel like telling them, okay, you know, I got the phone number of my postman, I can get, you know, you can call him if you don't want any. But the Lord has opened these doors and these connections, and I've got to tell you, as I go there, as I do these funerals, the ministry really isn't the funeral. The ministry is the time you spent with the family. We're in an area of the city where there's a lot of Greek Orthodox families. The Greek Orthodox in our area of the city will not do funerals for suicide victims. There's three or four Roman Catholic parishes around us who've taken the same approach. And so I do a lot of funerals for suicide victims. And I got to tell you, to do a suicide funeral is difficult. It's even worse when you get into context where you've got a family who's got no church connection, and the ministry is not the 35 or 40 minutes of the funeral. The ministry is during the visitation before and during the time after. And as I do that, I got to tell you what I see. I spend most of my time just listening to people's frustrations about the way they've been hurt by the church. So two Christmases ago, I get a call from these two sisters who want me to come and do the burial for their dad. And the burial's on the 27th of December between Christmas and New Year's. It's already hard because it's the wrong time of year for a funeral for somebody to pass away. And as I sit there during the visiting hours, there's this lull, you know, during the long visiting hours on the Thursday and the Friday before the Saturday funeral. There's moments during the day where nobody's there and you're there alone with the family, and that's ministry time. And I'm sitting with these two sisters, and these two sisters tell me the story of their dad. Their dad was 12. He was at the high school that was beginning to train priests, because if you're going to be a Roman Catholic priest, you're going to be celibate, and so you start from high school the training and the preparation for this. And so their dad is 12. He's at the high school where he's training for the priesthood. And one day the bishop comes to visit, and the bishop is visiting the classes, asking them questions to see how the teaching's going, how these future priests are doing. And because the bishop is there visiting, they're all standing. They stand at attention. The bishop comes in. He asks questions, interacts with them. And the bishop asks a couple questions and apparently had a bit of a sense of humor. And this young man misunderstood. The bishop asked what he thought was meant to be a funny question, because he asked him with it, and so he answered with a bit of a sense of humor, and the bishop got upset, didn't like the answer, and he wound up and punched him on the side of the head and knocked him to the floor. This young 12-year-old boy passed out, woke up with ringing in his ears, lost the hearing in his right ear, got sent home, and starting the following Sunday, his whole family stopped going to church, and that was it. Never went back to the Roman Catholic Church. But this young man had some kind of faith, continued to read the Bible, continued to pray. And fast forward, he's 82, struggling with cancer. And he talks to his girls about his funeral. And he says, at the funeral, find somebody who'll read the Bible and pray, but not a Roman Catholic. And the girls say, well, there's nobody else that prays and reads the Bible. Is in the father's, well, there's these weird people, they're called Protestants, and there's a couple around. See if you can find like a Protestant minister or a rabbi or somebody to come and read the Bible and do that. And so that's how I get called. And as I gradually, slowly, softly, gently approach the gospel with these two girls, for the first hour or two, I hear all the stories about the church, about Christian people who've disappointed them, about how the church has hurt them, about how the church hurt their father. And because, as Christian people, for 2,000 years, we have cut all kinds of corners, we're paying the price. The first great interaction between Muslims and Christians, as the Portuguese missionaries are making their way around Africa, and they get all the way around the Horn of Africa, and they get to the eastern side of Africa, and they discover that for years there's been active trade routes between the East Africans and the Indian subcontinent, and there are ships going back and forth. And as the Portuguese missionaries get into one of the ports on the eastern shore of Africa, this is in the end of the 7th century, they come across a ship full of Muslim pilgrims leaving East Africa to go to Mecca. And these fine Christian missionaries, they have to stop this. We can't let Muslim pilgrims go to Mecca. They're Muslims. They're worshiping Allah. And through a subterfuge, they get all the men off the ship. They load the ship with dynamite. and with 500 women and children, they blow it up in the port. And when Muslims tell the story of their encounter with Christians, this is historically the first great encounter between Muslims and Christians. The first terrorist encounter between Muslims and Christians was not the World Trade Center on September 11th. It was Christian Portuguese missionaries loading a ship full of 400 women and children on their way to Mecca with explosives and blowing it up in the port while they slaughtered their husbands in port. Who we are and how we do what we do matters a great deal. And so in our text today, we've got the first moment where Saul forgets that how you do things is as important as what you do. And he gets into a corner. And he cuts a corner. He offers a sacrifice himself. There's another event two chapters later. In that event, Saul is facing against the Amalekites. And there the story is different. As Saul faces off against the Amalekites, he doesn't make the mistake. He doesn't cut the corner because he's in pressure before the battle. It's after the battle. In 1 Samuel 15, Samuel and the forces have won the battle. They have defeated the Amalekites. They're fighting the Amalekites because when Israel came out of Egypt, they asked a number of countries for safe passage to let them get through to the promised land. There are some nations that refused them safe passage, and there are some nations that did worse. The Amalekites actually attacked them. The Amalekites waited till the Israelites were through, and when all of the seniors and the women and the kids who were dragging behind were in sight, the Amalekites swooped down and killed the seniors and the kids and the pregnant women that were the tail end of the Israelite convoy making its way to the promised land. And so God had promised one day Amalek is going to get its judgment. And this was it. God sends Saul to execute judgment on the Amalekites for what they had done on that day. And so in 1 Samuel 15, Saul is doing well. He won the battle with the Philistines. I'll tell you how that happened in a minute. Saul has won the battle with the Amalekites. God gives him instructions, and God says, everything here, all the cattle, everything, you burn it. You're not keeping anything. These people are so sinful. They're so steeped in idolatry. They are so evil. You want no remnants of these people left anywhere. And Saul almost obeys. Saul almost obeys. And in God's books, almost don't count. What do they say? Close only counts and horseshoes, nuclear weapons and dancing. And hand grenades, that's it. Saul almost obeys, and he allows King Agag to live. And Agag's family, it turns out. And the results of Saul's disobedience on that day are huge. Fast forward a couple hundred years, the people of Israel are in captivity during the story of the book of Esther. And there is a man who hates the Jews and wants to exterminate them. I love the way they tell this story in the synagogue. When they tell the story of the book of Esther in synagogues, all the kids have noisemakers. They're little wooden things. They go clack, 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 clack. And when you're telling the story, every time you pronounce the name of Haman, all the kids go clack, 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 so you can't hear his name being pronounced. Haman hates the Jews and wants them wiped out. And there's this passing comment in Esther chapter 3, verse 1. You know who Haman was a descendant of? Agag, the Amalekite. The people that Saul allowed to go free. That's the long shadow of our sin. Now, the difference between the two events is that in 1 Samuel 13, when Saul disobeys, he's in a corner. He's in a tough spot. He needs to cut the corner. He needs to take a shortcut because there's going to be disaster. But you know what happens? Once you take a shortcut because there's disaster coming, well, that was easy. Yeah. And then the next time there's a little bit of pressure, well, we can take the shortcut. And then by the time you get to 1 Samuel 15, there is no reason to take the shortcut whatsoever. They've won the battle. It's settled. They're victorious. They're free. Everything. And Saul takes the shortcut because that's what happens. That's what happens to your character. What you do in times of difficulty, what you do in times of stress, the shortcuts that you take when you think it's justified to take the shortcut, they come back and visit you when things are going well because you have moved the bar. You've moved the bar. You've moved the line. And out of that battle in 1 Samuel 15, come those memorable words. It's after that battle and after that disobedience that Samuel looks at Saul and says, "Does the Lord have any great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices or in obeying the voice of the Lord? To obey is better than sacrifice, and to listen is better than the fat of rams." And listen to this. "For rebellion is as the sin of divination, and presumption is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you've rejected the word of the Lord has rejected you." It's a sad, sad moment. Saul pleads for a second chance. Samuel says no. And Samuel turns to walk away, and you remember the scene. Saul reaches for him. He says, wait, and he grabs Samuel's cloak, and the cloak rips as Samuel keeps walking away. And the Lord says, "You see the way my cloak was ripped?" He says, "The kingdom's going to be ripped from your hands." And there's a sad text. It says, "The Lord was mourned and grieved that he had made Saul king over Israel." Imagine that. God, who had trusted Saul, God who'd had such high hopes for Saul, was grieved. Man, how much does it take before God is grieved? I always kind of think of God as the eternal optimist, don't you? How bad does it have to be for God to be grieved? Now, I want to tell you how the story ends back in 1 Samuel 13. So, because of Samuel's delay, the Philistines keep pushing forward, and they're pushing forward. And they're pushing forward, and they're expecting Saul to come out and meet them, and Saul's not coming out. And they're pushing, they've drawn the battle lines of the big open plain, and they're pushing and pushing, and they're waiting for Saul, and like, where's this army? We're waiting for them. And they keep pushing forward and forward and forward. And they finally get to this spot called Michmash. Michmash is a Hebrew word that means the hidden place. The way the country is made, there's the Cisjordan Mountains, and near the middle of Israel, where they are here, all of this narrows to a very narrow pass. And there's a strategic spot that's a narrow mountain pass at Michmash. So strategic is a spot, in fact, that for many years the Philistines had an outpost right there. This spot remained so strategic for a long time, in fact, that between the Old and the New Testament, when Jonathan Maccabee established his private residence in the headquarters of their revolt regime, it was situated right there by that narrow mountain pass. Now, if you are outnumbered by an enemy who has better spears and swords than you, and they have chariots and cavalry, and you don't have any of that, you don't want to meet your enemy in an open plain, right? Because in an open plain, the cavalry and the chariots attacking have full advantage against infantry. But that's what Saul was going to do. Saul was expecting to go down and meet the Philistines in the plain. It would have been murder. It would have been a disaster if that had happened. But as Saul waits for Samuel, and he waits, and he waits, and he waits, the Philistines, who had been lined up in battle array in the plain where they're waiting for the Israelites to come and meet them, are losing patience, and the Philistines, they move forward, they move forward, they move forward, until they reach this pass, and they can't get through. They're stuck at this pass, waiting for Saul to do something. And in the following chapter, Jonathan and his armor bearer, they're kind of curious. What's going on? Where are the Philistines? You know, so Dad's back waiting for Samuel and Jonathan and his armor bearer. They go to this little pass. And as they're sitting there in the pass, they get pretty bold. And they see a couple Philistines at the bottom of the pass. And they say, hey, you, what are you doing? Philistine comes up and they kill him. And another, and another, and another. And these two guys in the narrow pass, they managed to take out a couple dozen guys. Now, I got to tell you, if there's, you know, 30,000 chariots and cavalry and infantrymen coming at you in a force that's better armed and better equipped, and all you got is 600 guys, do you know how to want to take them on? You want to lure them into a narrow mountain pass. That's exactly what you want to do. Because of the delay, this is where the battle happened. God knew what he was doing. God knew that if a week before Saul and his 600 guys had gone down to the plain to meet the Philistines, it would have been disaster. The only way the Israelites could have won this is to wait out the Philistines, to let them come forward and forward and forward until they got their forces caught in this mountain pass. Jonathan and his armor bearer killed enough guys. It set panic in the camp. Philistines didn't know what was going on. It was the wrong time of day. They couldn't recognize each other. Some of them were still in their pajamas, didn't recognize their armors, and they started killing each other. And the Israelites who were hidden in the cave came out and routed them. And the Philistines thought, wow, what a great strategy. They had this plan all along. Well, somebody did. So at the Korean Presbyterian Church a couple Sundays ago, I inducted this young man. Auk arrived from Canada about 5 years ago to serve as part-time youth pastor at this Korean church. And he got one of these strange religious worker work visa that sort of allows him to do religious work but nothing else. And he sort of got a half status, and so he didn't quite qualify for Medicare coverage. And when I stepped in as interim moderator, I'd been there for a few months, and you know, things aren't going well. We had the minister left, and this young youth pastor is basically carrying the weight of the congregation alone. And he comes to me and he says, I got a problem I need your help with. He says, my work visa as a religious worker is 2 years, and it's going to expire. And I need a new visa, and to get the new visa, I need a letter from the church confirming my status of employment. And I said, okay. I said, well, who wrote the last one for you? He says it was, you know, one of the elders from the session, you know, and well, give me a copy of that letter and I can see. And he brings me a copy of this letter. And I said, look, I said, this letter says that you're working full time with benefits with. And Auk says, yeah. He says, they thought I needed that to get my visa renewed. But I said, Auk, you're at 18 hours a week with no benefits. And he says, yeah. He says, I questioned it when the elder sent in this letter. But he said, and Auk said, what do we do? And I said, well, I said, you know, the church is in no position to give you a full-time position with benefits. I said, the budget isn't even close to that. And I said, besides which, that's not what your contract says. And Auk says, yeah, but if you send them a letter that says that, you know, Auk is working for us at 18 hours a week with no benefits, he says, they probably won't give me a visa. And he says, on top of that, he said, they'll know that the other letter was a lie. And I got to tell you, this congregation is holding together because of the work of this young man. And, you know, I would have loved to, you know, signed a check and given them enough money to put them up to full time with benefits, but there was no money to do this. And he says, what do we do? And I said, you know what we do in these situations? I said, we tell the truth and we pray hard. That's what we do. And as I do this and I'm praying and I'm saying, Lord, you know what you're doing, but this young man has served faithfully this congregation. He's helped me to keep this congregation together. There's a couple members in the congregation who are deathly ill with cancer. He's been pastoring them. He's been preaching every Sunday. He's been carrying all of this. And his wife is pregnant. They have a third child on the way. I said, the last thing they need is you know, to be evicted from Canada. And to, you know, I said, Lord, I said, And so I wrote a confirmation letter that stated exactly the number of hours he was working, what his conditions were, and I was eulogious. I explained how much the church needed him, how helpful he was to the congregation, and how much he had done, and in spite of the fact that he was only remunerated 18 hours per week, that he was doing 8 days of work a week, I told the truth. And so we send this letter, and about 4 days later, Auk calls me on the phone, and he says, immigration called me, the federal government. I said, okay. They want me to come in tomorrow for an appointment at 9 a.m. I said, okay. He says, they told me to bring my passport, all my personal items, and my family with me to the meeting. He says, what do you think that means? I said, I think that probably means that you want to make sure you've got somebody to feed your goldfish when you're away. I think that's what that means. And so he shows up with his two little girls and his wife and their papers. And they wait in the office. Their meeting's at 9, they arrive at 9, they give in a copy of the letter again, all of their documents, and they sit in the waiting room until 4:45. And at 4:45, lady comes out, she's got an envelope. She says, here, this is for you. And because Auk and I had talked, he said, when the lady came out, he said, he's kind of looking behind her to see if there's a couple of RCMP officers who are going to take them to the airport. I mean, we're at that point, right? We're at that point because there was a false declaration made to fit. I said, look, I don't know how it works in other countries, but I said, in Canada, you don't lie to a federal official. You especially don't lie to a federal official who can check up to see whether you're saying the truth. And Auk called me from his cell phone in the car in the parking lot before they headed home. And it took me a little while to realize it was Auk because he was crying on the phone. And he tells me the story. He says, Joel, he says, they've made us wait all day. And he said, we were really worried. They tried to explain to her little girls what was going on. And he said, 4:45, this lady comes out, and she says, here this, and she says, excuse me, a letter. And it says, open the letter. And the letter says, we normally just grant 1 year visas, but you're doing very important work here. Here's a 2 year visa. And it would probably be helpful at this point for your wife to be able to work. Your wife now has the right to work in Canada. And then she says, your wife's pregnant, is she? And Auk says, yeah. She says, okay. She said, I called somebody in Quebec City, and she said, starting next Monday, the family's got Medicare coverage for everybody, including their baby. And Auk said, I couldn't help it. I asked, I said, but we're not supposed to get this. And the lady says, do you not want it? And he said, no, it's fine, thank you. I don't know how this happened. It shouldn't have happened. Somebody made a mistake. Somebody decided to be gracious. It was Thursday afternoon. Somebody was in a good mood. I don't know. I don't know what happened. And Auk said, I can't believe it. And I said, Auk, you say the truth and you pray hard. And I said, Auk, you're just starting your ministry. And I want to pray that God will bless your ministry. And I said, if your ministry in Canada has started on a lie, God can't bless your ministry. How can you start your ministry in Canada by lying to federal officials and expect the blessing of God? You say the truth, and you pray hard. Out of the grace of God, God took Saul out of a pinch. He didn't need to do the sacrifice himself. God was waiting. God knew exactly where the Philistines needed to be for the Israelites to win this battle. And if there had not been the 7 or 8 day delay, the Israelites would have lost this battle. God knew what he was doing. I know from experience how hard it is to wait for God's timing. But God's plans are always better than ours. And when we start making plans in an emergency because we're panicked, our plans get even worse. And I've learned this about God. God's really good in emergencies. Notice that. Notice that. Let's pray together. Father, as we seek to do your work, as we seek to do the ministry that we are called to do, remind us again that how we do it brings you as much glory as the fruit of the ministry. It's not just about what we're accomplishing. It's about who we're becoming. Amen.